Check one, mic one, check.
Check two, check two.
Hello.
No, come on. Have you never done a microphone check before?
I'm
sir,
here.
Please.
Fine, I'll be right into the mic.
Much better.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to welcome you to the Comedy Film Nerds podcast. My name is Graham Elwood.
And I'm Chris Mancini. And we're going to be talking about a lot of really interesting films today. We're going to be talking about Pete's Dragon, The Shallows, Cafe Society, Hell or High Water, Nerve, and going over some cool trailers like Rogue One and Dunkirk. And a couple surprises along the way as well.
Yep. Episode 333, guys. Halfway to 666. Episode of the Beast. So we're going to ramp up.
We should have Michael Bay on that episode.
Is that the end of times?
Yeah, it is. Days? Pretty much. It's the anti-filmmaking days. The end.
So that episode with him as a guest will just open up a portal into hell?
Yes, where they'll be showing better films.
Right. So even in hell, the films are better?
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
All right. I'm excited for that episode.
Yeah.
I'm excited for the episode of The Beast.
Yep.
We've got some fun. Oh, first I want to thank anybody that came out to the Huntsberger Junk Show that I did this past Sunday, August 14th. That was a lot of fun. And also anyone that was at the Pop Divas show last week at the Improv Lab. So at Pop Divas, we just recorded our fourth episode. It's a real show. I think some people don't believe. They think it's a fake.
Oh, they're not. I think you're just doing a bit.
Yeah. Like, aha, you and Joe Wagner aren't really talking about girl pop songs that you think are great. Yeah, we are. We've done four of them.
Yeah. If it's a joke, it's going on for a long time. It's 4 hours.
It's 333 hours of this goddamn joke. I'll tell you that much. Check out Pop Divas. And then we just added a new show to LA Podfest, The Conspiracy of Everything.
Mm-hmm.
So that's on the lineup is pretty much set. There's like three little spots that are open right now.
And we're talking to some people about those.
Yes, some cool shows in the works. Going to be some fun. A new different style of opening night party is going to happen.
Yeah, it could be really cool. We're working on some really neat stuff for this year.
So the tickets, the weekend passes are going. So there's a limited number of day passes too. The Saturday day passes are going quick.
Mm-hmm.
So get your tickets now, lapodfest.com. And of course, if you can't make it, the live video stream, the pay-per-view, all 40 shows and the six panels will be available.
Yes.
Live and also archived for the 30 days after the festival. That's $25. You save $5 if you use coupon code CFN.
Yeah, you're going to miss Will Wheaton? Come on.
Will Wheaton's
on the
show. It's
going to be amazing.
Come on now. Will Anderson from Tofop, of course, is flying down. Him and Charlie, I think, are flying up from Australia. They're doing this that crazy 36 hours. They're spending
of
more
travel.
Of travel for, to be here for 24 hours or something like
Good
that.
Good for them.
So that'll be cool, guys. Go to lapodfest.com.
That means we're going to have to do it at some point.
We're going to
have to.
Well, we've done it already. I'll go down there.
Just to,
anybody wants to drop the money, we'll come down to Australia and record a CFN episode.
Again.
And as we've been proven, you don't need to live there.
No.
All right. So let's introduce our guest. And we'll let him go into what his film background is.
Yes.
David Huntsberger introduced us, and of course he was on the show that we just did Sunday night. Ladies and gentlemen, Samuel Prime.
Hello, gentlemen. Thanks for having me.
Sure, man. So go into you do a lot of film restoration and film advocacy.
Yeah.
So tell us what you've been working on.
Absolutely.
What exactly is film advocacy?
Yeah.
Our listeners may not know.
Of course. Yeah. My background is all in like film archiving and film history. And for me, what film advocacy is just supporting old, forgotten, lost movies in every possible aspect of life. That means film restoration. That means writing actively about films that may have fallen off the map.
So go into restoration real quick, because mm-hmm. some people might not know.
Yeah, of course.
Like, what that process is.
Well, first and foremost, I think the heart of film restoration is based in obsession. It's becoming obsessed with a movie that maybe isn't out there or is forgotten in some way. I think the best case study, at least in my own history, is a film called Catch My Soul, which is a 1974 rock musical version of Othello that was directed by Patrick McGoohan and stars Richie Havens. It's a film that...
Patrick McGoohan from The Prisoner?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow!
It was the only feature film that he ever directed.
And Richie Havens?
And Richie Havens.
Richie
who
Havens.
In Woodstock.
Yeah. There's that great story in the Woodstock documentary when he went out there and just went, freedom! He was like told to stall.
Yeah.
That's what he just said. Sometimes...
They're just like, keep going!
They kept like stretching, like some band was late or something like that, and Richie Havens just
improvised all the stuff that became kind of legendary.
I mean, one of the things that's so important about film restoration is the older films, some of them are disintegrating, literally. You know,
yeah, 35mm prints.
Yeah, you open up the film can, and it'll be sometimes dust inside.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, the films that are of the greatest interest to me are usually films that are sort of like in the early 70s to about the mid 70s. And that's really the time period in American film history and film history generally where the film stock itself is kind of the most subject to degradation and discoloring. In the early 1980s, they switched from like an acetate film stock to a polyester, which is much more robust and has like a longer lifespan. But these films right in that early to mid 70s point tend to fade to a sort of like pinkish reddish hue and then get that what they call vinegar syndrome, where they start to deteriorate and you can really smell the decay of the film.
Wow.
But in the case of Catch My Soul, it was about becoming obsessed with this movie that came out theatrically very briefly in the New York City area and sort of in and around that circuit, if you will, but then completely vanished from the map. It was never released on home video. It did have a sort of brief re-release under the title Santa Fe Satan several years later. That was when the film was sold to New Line Cinema, but... For about 40 years, nobody had ever seen or heard of this film. And for me, it was something I became completely obsessed with. I was like, I need to see this movie. And through working with some really good friends and through meeting the right people who were associated with the film, we were able to, as of about November of 2015, finally strike a deal and release this movie on home video for the first time, both DVD and Blu-ray.
Wow. So how did... Now... In terms of specifically film restoration, did you study, go to school for that?
Or? I did, yeah. I started studying it kind of informally at the end of undergraduate at Northwestern University.
Then
I went to UCLA for a formal program called Moving Image Archive Studies, in which I focused very explicitly on film history, archiving, curatorial practices, and restoration.
That's awesome.
Now, are there different processes?
I went to high school in Evanston. So I was Italian.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, the brothel law. Yeah. You know what I'm talking about.
Chicago thing.
Yeah, well, yeah. Northwestern is in Evanston, and so that was...
They have a lot of strange laws in Evanston.
Evanston's got a lot of strange laws.
Famously a dry county for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, like, started in Evanston, so you couldn't buy...
Oh, they're like my favorite band.
They're phenomenal. Oh my God, I saw them at Coachella like 3 years ago. They were amazing.
So what I was wanted to ask is that when you have the very old films, like 30s, 40s,
sure.
Is the restoration process different than movies made like in the 70s? And like what are the challenges?
I mean, the actual process is pretty similar. Mm-hmm. I think with any film, whether it's from the 30s or the 40s or into the 70s or even earlier or more contemporary than that, it's typically a process of cleaning the film, scanning it into a sort of digital intermediate. Most of the actual restoration nowadays is done digitally and then output back to film or another digital medium.
Right.
Oh, okay.
It's that, you know, with a film from like the 20s or 30s and a film, say, like Catch My Soul from the 70s, what you might actually be doing digitally is a little bit different. You know, a black and white film from the 30s might not need the same degree of...
Oh, right.
Like... color grading as a film that had faded to the sort of like deep red or pink color as Catch My Soul had. So there's a lot of different color grading.
I wish Tawan was on this episode right now so we could go into the specifics, because he does color correction and what the grading would be from a movie from the 70s. Mm. I'd love to hear about that.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes, like, I know there's a story about Metropolis where, you know, they could never find a completed film for years and years and years. There was always missing footage. Like, if you watch Metropolis, there's cards that come up when their footage is missing. And then a few years ago, someone found a completed print. So that has to be guys like you that were literally been searching for it for years.
Yeah, and sometimes that kind of stuff happens so randomly, too. Mm-hmm. You know, I think with Metropolis, I think we'll be getting new versions of that film every 5 years, you know, for the end of time, basically. but with something like Catch My Soul and these other sort of more marginal, lesser-known films, it really is just kind of... In most cases, it takes someone who really has a kind of laser-like focus on this title and says to themselves or amongst colleagues, like, this is something worth consideration. Even if it didn't quite work in its original release, or if it's been missing for 40 years, having it back on shelves and having someone in any town, in any... whether it's America or whether you're living anywhere around the world, to be able to go to like a video store or just log on and go to Amazon and order a copy of this thing is something of value and is worth pursuing.
That's what happened with Mark Allen Miller when he tracked down the Nightbreed footage when they did the director's cut. That story that they told here on one of the previous episodes was amazing. Like some of the old VHS were like sitting in Clive Barker's house, and they didn't know it. And then they finally found, like, in a warehouse, the actual footage to be able to put it together. It's amazing.
I love the sort of the mystery surrounding some of the restoration in terms of, like, what we found this box of thing, and a guy had a yard sale or whatever.
Like, at some point in the story, it's always like the footage disappears somewhere.
Right. Yeah,
and it's like you have to be a detective to track it down.
It really is kind of like detective work. You'd be surprised, or maybe not, about how many times like films are saved by almost accident or just by happenstance. The films by these independent filmmakers in the 70s, the 60s, the 80s are just sitting in their garage uncared for. And all it takes is someone who says, hey, where is that film? Well, you know, why isn't that film available? And they just, you know, make a phone call, contact the filmmaker, and like literally just go spelunking into their garage and say, oh yeah, there's that movie I made 30 years ago. And then it, you know, gets into the hands of responsible caretakers like UCLA or like the Academy, and then can be properly preserved and cared for and cleaned and hopefully made available in more consumer mediums like DVD and Blu-ray.
That's awesome. Like that. That's awesome. All right. What are you, any restoration you're working on currently?
Not right now. The two most recent titles that I've worked on were Catch My Soul, which came out in November of last year, and a film by James B. Harris called Some Call It Loving, which came out earlier in 2015. Right now, I find myself kind of obsessed with a couple of titles. Some that are, as you alluded to earlier, it's very much like detective work. It's about putting together the pieces and trying to get in touch with these people who were independent filmmakers working outside of a studio system, outside of any major distributors. And sort of the difficulty that comes with that is tracing ownership and trying to figure out contact names and info for companies and people who might not exist any longer. In particular, the couple of titles I'm really fascinated with now and sort of trying to do my detective work on, one is a film called Hollywood 90028 by a female film director named Christina Hornischer. It's a sort of like exploitation, sexploitation picture, again, from sort of like the mid-70s, about a guy living in Los Angeles and sort of wanting to work professionally in the film world, but settling for being a cinematographer for these like nudie cutie porno films. And it's kind of a horrifying movie in that he's sort of driven by his extreme loneliness to hurt everyone around him, and not just emotionally hurt them, but to actually like strangle and kill the people he loves. It's an incredible movie, a movie that captures a lot of Los Angeles, both geographically and sort of in the emotional spirit of it as well. And it's something that was just produced by companies and people who no longer exist. A company called American Films Limited. I don't know who they are. You know? And Christina Hornisher doesn't exist any longer. She passed away about 10 years ago. So, you know, it is detective work in some way or another.
That's so fascinating because, like, that, the you know, the 70s produced so many dark.
You betcha.
Really, like, you know, there was such a, in America, you know, you had the post-Vietnam, post-Watergate, civil rights, feminism, all of these, like, America was really questioning itself on a lot of levels.
You had everything from Easy Rider to Dirty Harry, and there was all sorts of, it ran the
because you're also coming off of two Kennedys getting assassinated, Martin Luther King.
It was unquestionably a nihilistic time.
Like, everyone was like, what is the point? You know, environmentalism was finally getting talked about, and overpopulation. And
that's another thing with this movie. The ending is so nihilistic.
Right.
I don't want to spoil it for you, but I mean, it is just, it's something that once seen absolutely cannot be forgotten.
Right, because if you look at, like, Planet of the Apes, Omega Man, you know, like, Dirty Harry, it was all these, like, the end of the movie was never, like, the wave the flag we won. It's like Dirty Harry chucks his badge into the water and is like, I'm out.
Can I spoil the ending of Hollywood 90028?
Sure.
Ooh, all right. Spoiler alert, guys. It's Hollywood.
Because keep in mind, this is a movie that you may never be able to see.
Yeah, it's so.
with any luck, hopefully people will be able to see this. Mm-hmm. The only version of it that I know that exists in a viewable form currently is a rip that someone made online from, like, an early 1980s UK VHS cassette under the title Insanity in all capital letters.
All right, so spoiler alert for Insanity or Hollywood 90028.
Also known as Twisted Throats or the Hollywood Hillside Strangler in different releases. So the end of the movie is sort of the pinnacle of sadness for this character, Mark. He's finally in a relationship with a woman. He thinks he's on the verge of happiness. They sleep together, and he wakes up the next morning, and he strangled the woman that he loves. And so the final shot of the film is a shot that pulls away very quickly, but it's him hanging himself on the Y in the Hollywood sign. And it begins with a close-up as he jumps off the Y, and it's this extreme, like, helicopter shot of a helicopter moving backwards, and so you see his body dangling.
Yeah, there were no drones back then.
No.
With the cameras on.
Yeah, that's a helicopter shot. Yeah.
This is clearly, like, an illegally obtained shot and totally guerrilla style, you know?
Wow.
With a helicopter.
And it's just like as his scream sort of reverberates on the soundtrack. It's just something that absolutely cannot be forgotten once seen.
Well, that's our episode, guys.
Right. I'm that happy.
Good luck.
Show business is hard, guys.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk some movies now.
Let's do it. Let's start with Pete's Dragon after that.
After the Hollywood suicide. All right, let's go to Fun Little Kids Movie.
Yes. This was a really interesting movie to watch just from a filmmaking perspective and a marketing perspective. Disney is going through their vaults and basically remaking a lot of these old films and also remaking the animated movies as live action. Now, Pete's Dragon was an oddity at its time where it was a live-action feature, but with an animated dragon. So it was a hybrid kind of movie, the original.
And they're sort of doing that again, sort of what they did with Jungle Book, kind of?
Well, not really. It was more like now with the advancement in computer graphics, it was basically a photorealistic dragon. So, yes, it's animated, but it looks more like the the background.
But they have live-action characters in it?
So it's a live-action movie.
Oh.
And then the only computer-generated character is the dragon. So
the original one came out in 1977.
Yes. So it's interesting, too, because it was really following kind of like this Jungle Book kind of like a plot line where, here's a boy trapped in the wild for a long time. The dragon finds him and raises him. But then he gets back to the civilization and some A-list movie stars like Robert Redford, who's not quite in the movie as much as you would think from the trailer.
Right.
And, you know, he wasn't in it quite as much. Oh, okay. And Dallas Bryce Howard, who, by the way, is the best thing that Ron Howard ever made. And
I don't know. Grand Theft Auto is pretty good.
Grand Theft Auto is pretty great.
Love Grand Theft Auto.
So, but here was what's really interesting about this movie. There's not one frame, not one image at all that is different, surprising, or not like signed off by 1,000 Disney executives. Uh-huh. Like it was by the book remake filmmaking. Whereas Jungle Book was really interesting. I mean, Jon Favreau did some interesting things with it, where this one, it's, you know, boy gets lost, befriends an animal, quote, dragon. The other loggers find it dangerous. They go out to chase him, Carl Urban. Everyone kind of walks through the parts. I mean, Dallas Bryce Howard and Robert Redford try to bring something to the script, but there's just nothing there. I mean, you've seen it 100 times before. But here's where it gets interesting. The film is not a family film. It's a kids' film. 100% kids film. There's no very few, unless they're for a nostalgic perspective, are going to see this movie. It's not like a Pixar movie where everyone kind of goes to see it.
So kids should go alone.
Kids should go alone. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So I would say like it almost like skewed like 8 and under, but my 11-year-old still liked it. So I would say probably 12 and under. But there is no effort to entertain an adult in that film at all.
Wow.
It literally is for kids. And to be fair, it is marketed that way too. This is a kids movie. It's really a G movie, but for marketing, no one puts G on it anymore because, well, no, it has to be at least PG for, you know, for even the 8-year-olds to be interested anymore.
Throw a parent in there.
Yeah. So it was one of those real by the numbers filmmaking. Now, was it incompetently made or anything like that? No, it was just a literally paint by the numbers family movie that we've done before. And that it was, you know, like I said, it looked like 100 Disney executives signed off on every single shot and scene.
Because that would make sense because, like, the director is David DeLowery, who did Ain't Them Body Saints and Saint Nick and Dead Room, who has sort of a gritty indie background.
Right. Yeah, believe me, he was clamped down.
Okay.
There was nothing, like I said, there was not one interesting shot or sequence or frame that you go, oh wow, I've never seen that before. That was really interesting. Even the dragon design alone, like, you know, the little, we have a little trivia that was made furry to seem more huggable. And also the dragon is made kind of to look a little bit like a dog. To see kind of like, oh, well, you know, it's man's best friend, and it's, you know, the kid's friend.
The
yeah.
Dragon.
So, and so there's nothing even that menacing about the dragon. Like, and I know that's kind of not the point, but still, it would be interesting if, like, there was some different thematic element put in this movie. Like, even the beginning when, like, you know, you have to explain how this kid ended up in the forest alone where the dragon finds him, you know, car accident. Parents die, but even that is handled so kind of like sanitized that it's like, okay, well, we know what happened. You don't have to sanitize it, everything, because we've seen from Disney movies they don't have to be sanitized. And, you know, it's an interesting difference between, like, the golden age of live action Disney filmmaking. There was always like those two tracks. There was always the ones that were made for kids, like Apple Dumpling Gang and, you know, the Herbie movies and all those. But then you also had 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and Treasure Island, where these were classic stories that they were made, but and they were made and they were not dumbed down or kiddified.
Right.
So, whereas Jungle Book, I thought went more towards, well, this is going to entertain everyone. This one is like, no, this is specifically for kids. We're not even going to pretend it's for adults. So I would say if you don't have children, there's no reason for you to see this film at all. So it was. I would have liked to have seen a little bit more, but I will say it was, you know, competently made, basically good entertainment for a child 12 and under, and that's pretty much all it is.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about Hell or High Water.
Yes. Also a kids' movie.
Hilarious. Fun family film. It's two brothers going on some wacky bank robbing hijinks in West Texas.
Yeah.
The sad thing is that that would have been a live-action Disney movie like 30 years ago.
Right, and they've got a talking horse that helps them rob the banks.
I would so fucking watch that.
I'd watch that.
This bank-robbing horse? Are you kidding?
Are you kidding?
Yeah, great.
Bucky, the bank-robbing horse.
Hand over the money.
Yeah, I'm in. Yeah. We'll green light it.
Yeah. This did not have a bank robbing horse, sadly.
God damn it. Maybe the sequel.
This film, I think it got kind of a limited release.
Yes.
And I'm not going to see Suicide Squad. I can't do it. So,
I can't blame you.
Our guest has a different opinion on that. Yes. But,
well, again, Assault on Arkham. See that instead.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't hate it. I didn't hate Suicide Squad. Didn't do it. Didn't hate it.
All right, guys, you can talk to Samuel online about that.
Yeah, hit me up at SBPrime on Twitter and yell at me a lot.
My favorite part of you saying you didn't hate it, though, was when you went, well, don't get me wrong, it is a mess.
It is a mess. It is a mess, but as someone who was not at all familiar with these characters, right. I know I'm in the minority for that.
You enjoyed it for what it was.
But I enjoyed it for what it was, and I think that there's actually spectacular production design, spectacular costumes, but with the caveat, I do want to see a re-edit of the movie with absolutely no dialogue.
That's not enough to make me want to go see it, which is why I saw Hell or High Water. So. I like this film a lot, actually. The basic story is Ben Foster and Chris Pine are brothers. Ben Foster is he's a trouble-in-and-out-of-prison guy. He's out of prison. Right.
And that's their names, Hell and High Water.
Yeah, it's a cop duo. The poster is them like shoulder to shoulder, like
you know. It's a living
with a horse.
Yeah, with a talking horse.
Oh, High Water, get in here!
Hell!
Oh, High Water, you are more like your brother.
You guys are hellbent on making this a stupid movie.
I think you mean an incredible movie.
Incredible film, right. The best movie that's ever been made.
Yes.
So tell us about the high water.
It's
how high does the water get?
Well, yeah, the water gets really high. There's no flooding in this, guys. High or high water is an expression, guys, that is used. It's a sort of a colloquial parlance, meaning I'm going to do this no matter what.
Right. Okay.
So just to clarify, and you guys or any other morons listening to this show,
So what's this movie about?
This movie is about these two brothers. Their family farm is facing foreclosure. And
would you say the farm is underwater?
Yes, Chris, it is underwater. Again, not literally. That's a financial term. So we're going to go over through a lot of different terms, guys, a lot of cute local phrases and cultural idioms. Mm-hmm. So they've realized that our only option is to rob banks.
Okay.
And this movie has a lot of social commentary about the banking industry. The whole movie takes place in these small towns in West Texas where like the one town, and Jeff Bridges is the cop who's about to retire, who's like, I got one more hunt in me, you know? So there's that. Mm-hmm. He is riding a cliche horse through fucking cop town, but it's handled well. And Jeff Bridges is the...
Was it right before retirement?
Oh yeah. I mean, literally like, but I'll give, without giving any spoilers, this movie and the director, David McKenzie, who actually directed a movie called Asylum in 2005.
That is awesome.
So,
I hope his movie is getting confused with mine.
Oh, that'd be great. His fans are like, what is this? He's done a bunch of films I really haven't heard of much. Tonight, Your Mind, Perfect Sense, Spread. He's an interesting filmmaker, and it's done a lot of indie stuff. The thing I liked about this movie is there are some kind of cliches and stuff set up in the beginning that get played with. And so that I don't want to give any more away, but that is really interesting. So, and the movie also has a really great sense of humor. They're these two brothers, and then there's just all this sort of, they cast, my guess is he cast a lot of people from West Texas that are like, they're great character actors, and they're all West Texas, like, you know, I'd string him up and wrap him, you know, like, mm-hmm. I'll have him field dressed and on my hood in 30 minutes, you know, you know, like, there's a lot of that. So there's this great sense of humor to it, and then this sort of brutality of, you know, this is no joke. Holding armed bank robbery is not a fun, it's not a joke, it's not a video game.
Right.
And Jeff Bridges, and he's a Texas Ranger. So, and you know, there's some cool stuff in the beginning. These brought, and he's like, do you want this? He's like, how come the FBI doesn't take it? This FBI handles bank robbery. Well, these guys were smart enough to only take small amounts of cash and, you know, whatever's in the drawer, and they don't take the hundreds and all this stuff. And it's like, okay.
Now, does that not trigger an FBI investigation? Is that what they were doing?
That's what they're saying. They're saying an FBI investigation. I don't know if this is actually the truth, but this is the pretense in the film, is that an FBI investigation is triggered when you steal large, like, we got $100,000 out of the bank. These guys are getting like $7,000-$8,000 to throw. And they're doing that intentionally, and they're hitting the bank that is leaning on them for the mortgage.
Oh, right.
So it is this big, like, and then there's this kind of, some of the small town people are like, that bank's been stealing from me for years. Good for, you know, like, there's that. And then there's just a commentary, like, they're in this small town, and Jeff Bridges and his, this younger Texas Ranger who's, his character is half Latino and half Native American. So Jeff Bridges is making all of these dumb racist jokes, which is sort of funny, the way he's old man Texas style. And then, and then the guy's like getting annoyed and pissed off with, and then he starts giving him back, and Bridges is like, there you go, now you're getting the hang of it. You told me, you know, like, but he's sitting there, and they're like, look, we're in this small town. There's one diner with this mean waitress. The hardware store is selling stuff twice as much as Home Depot. What, like, it's sort of, I don't know. And it's written by Taylor Sheridan, who is done a lot of acting, but also Taylor Sheridan has done some of the, he wrote Sicario. So
talk about a great movie.
That's a great movie. And you want to talk about a film, like, he has way more actor credits on TV. He's a TV actor. He's been in a million TV shows, but his first writer credit is Sicario. Now, you want to talk about a movie with social commentary, and I mean, so it's really cool how this writer is commenting on this, and like, there's a spray paint, there's graffiti on, it says 3 tours to Iraq, but I didn't get a bailout. You know, so it's just short of showing how like the working man has been screwed over by the banks at every turn, and everyone is falling victim to this. So that is really interesting, and you know, Ben Foster plays such a great fuck up. He's just
in many different films.
Oh God, he's so good at it. And playing this like Texas, you know, cowpoke in and out of prison.
Wasn't he an Alpha Dog? He played this ex-con.
Man. Is he in the 310 to Yuma remake too?
Yeah, he's in that too.
Yes.
He disappears into characters, I feel like.
Yeah, he does.
To his credit.
To his credit. And it's a testament, because it's not like, oh, there's Ben Foster doing his Ben Fosterisms. You're like, that's a believable character.
And you also don't realize, like, he's actually younger than he looks in some of these characters.
Yeah, true.
He's 40. And here, no, he isn't.
He seems like the kind of actor who'd, like, pull out a tooth for a role.
Right?
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
He would have no reservations about it. He'd be like, no front teeth? Okay.
Do it.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Out. Not that that's what Ben Foster sounds like, but I think he's a committed guy.
But also then, it's really great to see Chris Pine. Chris Pine is a pretty boy. He's a leading man. He's Captain Kirk. You know, he's in a lot of rom-coms and shit like that. And this is, he's, you know, a smart guy that, like, I don't know what else to do. And it's a really, their dynamic is really compelling. And then the Jeff Bridges and his cop buddy is compelling. And then how those guys interact with other people as they're committing the crimes and as Jeff Bridges is chasing them down. And so there's just a lot of, you know, great scenes where Jeff Bridges is, you know, interviewing people after the fact to get stats and how he does his police work. And it's just a surprising film. In the sense, like, I saw a trailer a couple months ago. I was like in a theater and saw a trailer. There's not a lot of press for this film, and I was like, "Huh? Wait a minute. What? You know, like this could be really good. It's worth seeing. And it's really cool. And they shot it in New Mexico apparently, probably because of all the tax credits you get in New Mexico. But I'd love to know anybody
for now.
Yeah, for now. I'd love to know anybody who lives or is from West Texas to get what their take on this is. Morgan, I know you live in Texas. I can't remember if it's West or East Texas, but to know, did this feel accurate to you, or was it a Hollywood version of it? It felt accurate to me just because I was like, the casting, I was like, those are Texans. That's not a guy from LA, you know? So it's really cool. And I think, you know, if this is Taylor Sheridan's first two scripts, yeah. And McKenzie, like David McKenzie, I'm all for it. So it was a good movie. I liked it a lot.
Cool. All right. Well, then let's go to The Shallows. This is a movie that I believe is still playing in a couple of theaters, and we missed it. It was Blake versus Shark.
Yeah. Yeah, this movie, I mean,
Remember that Spielberg movie, The Chase? Was it like that with like a surfer and a shark?
Wait, what movie is this? What are you talking about?
Spielberg's first before he did Jaws, he did a TV movie. I think it was called The Chase.
Duel.
Duel. That was
Duel. That's what it's called.
Yeah, it was Duel. And but it was like that. It was literally a car versus a truck.
I'm surprised you didn't compare it to that other movie Steven Spielberg made. What was it called? Oh, yeah, Jaws.
Didn't feel like Jaws.
You know, for me, Blake Lively is America's sweetheart. I think anyone who can deliver the line with a straight face, while I was having orgasms, he was having wargasms.
What's that from?
That's from Savages, the Oliver Stone movie, which is terrible. Anyone who can deliver that line with a straight face, for me, like, wins a lot of points. Didn't commit herself to that kind of a role in a garbage movie called Savages. But for this, Blake Lively basically plays a kind of gringa on a vision quest who's sort of lamenting the death of her mom and decides to go visit this beach that was very important to her mother. And in doing so, doesn't really bother to tell anyone where she's going, why she's doing this, and, you know, ends up...
Plays right into the shark's hands.
Plays right into the shark's hands. And it's a very simple summer movie. I mean, it's no more than the sum of its parts, really. It's Blake Lively getting stranded on a rock and having to fend herself off and sort of fight against all the odds and against time to... you know, mend her own wounds.
Because doesn't the tide come in, too?
Tide plays a major factor in this movie. Mm-hmm. Although, I would add that the tide, like, isn't a problem at the very beginning, but then suddenly is a problem. I'm not sure why that's true. But yeah, there's a whole backstory of, like, Blake Lively wanting to, like, go to med school and become a doctor. So because of that, she's able to treat her wounds. And, you know, that's a little hackneyed and a little bit annoying. But really, this is a summer movie about,
like... There's some great line of dialogue, like, Mom, are we going to go over the med school thing again? Like, is it that? Like,
there is a little bit of that kind of stuff happening. You know, it's, like, a lot of Blake Lively looking at her phone and looking at, like, pictures of her mom who like died of cancer or something. But I mean, really, this is a movie that,
like,
that is
good thing I took that survival course anyway.
Oh boy, that's convenient.
Good thing I took that shark fighting course.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's kind of like, it's not a perfect movie by any stretch, but it's like exactly what I want in a summer movie. It's exactly what I want in a summer movie. It's Blake Lively fights shark. Yes, sign me up. I also saw this movie at like 10 o'clock in the morning on a Thursday at the Grove. I was literally the only person in the theater. Oh,
wow. You're going to, you know, do you have kids?
I do not.
Yes, because that's dad time to see movies.
It's an amazing time to see movies.
Yeah.
Like that movie works. I think, I mean, I don't have anything to compare it against because I only saw this movie once, but it, for me, worked excellently well being the only person in a giant dark theater. I felt like the shark was going to come after me. Also, Blake Lively fucking lights this shark on fire. If that doesn't sell a ticket, no, I don't know what is.
Spoiler
alert. That might be a spoiler alert.
Nah. You need to know that going in. Yeah. You need to know that going in. Blake Lively lights a fucking shark on fire.
All right.
All right.
That's great.
So the next movie is Cafe Society. This is Woody Allen's 47th directed film.
Mm-hmm. Ugh, stop already.
And there's a little bit of interesting trivia. Like, it's the first one he's shot digitally. And Steve Carell replaced Bruce Willis, who was fired after the cast tired of his behavior and his inability to remember his lines. Which
was he wearing a Trump
really
hat the whole time?
It's really funny.
Oh, dear.
So
a logical replacement, though.
And also, when you do a Woody Allen movie, there's the cast is usually so large. How many days are you really working? I mean, you couldn't pull it together for, what, a few days? Now, the thing about Woody Allen movies is they always have this, there's certain elements in every single one. There's the young character who is surprisingly like Woody Allen, like Jesse Eisenberg plays like with the young Woody Allen. And it was a really kind of fun anti-summer movie. Like, you know, I just got tired of watching things blow up. And to watch like kind of a period piece set in the 30s about, you know, basically cafe society in Hollywood and in New York. And it was like a really nice just kind of like palate cleanser, if you will, for with summer movies. However, there's a couple things that I want Woody Allen to stop doing in his films. There's a lot of things I'd like him to stop doing in his life. But but in his films,
molesting your kids, stuff like that.
Yeah. In his films, like, this has to be an ego thing. Like, he does a voiceover throughout the entire film. I don't need it narrated by Woody Allen. And then there was one spot where Jesse Eisenberg did the voiceover. I'm like, oh, okay, well, are we switching? Is this a younger or older version? And like, nope, it was completely random. It was Jesse Eisenberg does one voiceover, and the rest are all is just Woody Allen literally narrating the film, which we did not need at all. So
that does seem completely egregious.
And I will say Kristen Stewart did a nice job. You know, it's interesting to see her with an actual character, what she can do with it. It wasn't a 100% fully fleshed out character, but it was better than someone falling in love with a vampire. So it's still, it was nice to see.
Did you see Clouds of Souls Maria?
I have not seen that.
Yeah.
She's
very good at that.
Yeah. Kristen Stewart is amazing in that
movie. So it's nice to actually see her get, you know, some material.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the best example of Kristen Stewart,
I think so too.
With a good script.
Yeah.
And a good character. And
I'll have to see that.
And how she's able to, you know, I talked about when that movie came out, but like, she's the assistant to the movie star, so she's not the number one figure in that world,
right?
You know what I mean? So she's usually the focus of whatever world she's in, and she kind of isn't in that one, which is more interesting to me,
right?
Anytime a big star like that, and I really do think Kristen Stewart is a big star, has a kind of supporting role or is a little bit left of center, I think that's when they really shine. I mean, you mentioned Chris Pine earlier. I think he is the most entertaining and really resonates the most for me when he is in these kind of sideline characters.
Right. See, that, again, and that's why Hell or High Water worked is because it isn't Chris Pine starring Pine. It's like this on it's three big name actors. Mm-hmm. So they're all just given really good parts, and that's what works. But anyway.
Yeah, so this movie was kind of like a little pieces of every other Woody Allen movie. You've got, you know, someone moving out to Hollywood in the 30s to try to make their way, and you know, and you've got the brother who's a gangster. You know, you've got a little bit of Bullets Over Broadway. You've got a little bit of stuff, and you've got married man falling in love with a much younger woman that is also in there. But the thing I liked about
also
it
boo.
Is that it is, like I said, it was just because it came out in the summer. It was like kind of this anti-explosion movie where you can actually sit and watch characters and dialogue and human relationships. And it was, if it kind of came out like during Oscar season, it's interesting. I don't think I would have liked it as much, like, because that's when you're actually seeing all of the good drama. Mm-hmm. Like, this movie is nowhere near, like, Blue Jasmine, which I really liked. This one is more like, all right, well, this is kind of other Woody Allen movies cobbled together. But because it came in the summer and because I've seen a lot of stuff blow up. I did find myself enjoying it as like a almost like a diversion to what the other summer movies mm-hmm. are. So it's worth a view. This is a plain movie.
So wait, I want to know why, Sammy, why you have so many boos to all of this. Are you just done with Woody Allen, or what is it?
I totally am. I'm totally done. I've never really been a fan of Woody Allen's movies. I've never really naturally gravitated towards them. I've maybe seen, I don't know.
Out of the 47, I've
probably seen five, maybe. Mm. And they have all been garbage to me.
Wow.
The only one that I sort of liked was Midnight in Paris, and I think that is also the most recent one I have seen, too.
Right, which came out.
But even that felt to me
like... And that was Owen Wilson playing Woody Allen.
Right.
Right. But, I mean, for me, that movie is also, like, the reason that I am sort of entranced with it is because of its setting, you know? It's because of its existence in sort of 20s Paris.
And that's one of the charms of this film, too. You look at the kind of, basically, it's in the title, it's Cafe. It's that society in Hollywood, but then also in New York. Now, it's not quite the love letter to old Hollywood that the last Coen Brothers movie was. Mm-hmm. The one that came out, I can't remember, blanking on
Hail name, Caesar.
Right? Yeah, Hail Caesar, yeah. It doesn't have that kind of affection. It just kind of has it more as the setting, and it's more about like basically the society that everyone kind of and the circles that they would go into parties and all those things. Steve Carell plays, you know, he plays the sleazy agent, and it's, but again, he does a good job with it. He's interesting to watch. It's interesting. I couldn't imagine watching Bruce Willis in that role after seeing Steve Carell in it. I'm like, I think it worked out better.
Yeah.
It's by far not his best film, but it is charming, and it is a good diversion from summer movies right now. So,
all right,
it's decent.
Samuel, you saw Nerve.
Yeah.
Tell us about this film. I don't know much about it.
Oh, brother, Nerve. It's like
based
the
on
new
Jeannie Ryan novel.
News to me. News to me. Basically, for me, this was something that I wasn't too aware of prior to seeing it.
Oh, I did see a trailer for this.
The trailer for this gives away too much. So if someone hasn't seen the trailer yet, I really advise against it. I watched it after watching the movie, and I was like, I probably would not have gone to see the movie had I seen the trailer. But that said, this is a movie by the same people who made the documentary Catfish. A number of years ago,
Henry, and this is Joost and Ariel Schulman,
yeah. And this movie is kind of startlingly contemporary, and it is all about like an augmented reality game. It's basically a kind of truth or dare minus the truth aspect. It's like if Periscope had a dare function, and it's kind of like this clandestine app that like all the hip kids are using, like all the hacker kids. And
parents just don't get it.
Parents don't even know about it, man. Don't tell your parents. Don't tell the cops either. You can log onto this app and you can choose to be a player or a watcher. And if you're a watcher, you just get to participate and sort of come up with dares for the people who are the players. And the main actors in this are Dave Franco and Emma Roberts, who sort of, by virtue of this app/game, sort of run into each other when Emma Roberts is dared to sort of kiss a stranger in a sort of public space. And Dave Franco happens to be holding her favorite book, which is also his dare, you find out shortly thereafter. So she targets him, they kiss, and they end up becoming dare partners.
It was like a meet cute app.
Sort of.
Is it sort of like the modern version of The Game with...
It is. Right. It is a lot like that movie. And I mean, I love David Fincher's The Game, and I love Michael Douglas in that movie. This is very much a modern version of that. And for me, it's absolutely the most fun I've had at the movies this summer.
Oh, wow.
It doesn't quite stick the landing as it's transitioning into the third act.
Right.
It shakes a little bit. But I think I can forgive that because what precedes it is just such
riotous fun.
Mm-hmm. And it also doesn't take itself too seriously. Like it knows how ridiculous the premise is.
Right.
The idea of embracing this kind of contemporary culture and throwing these people into situations where they're basically asked to either risk their lives or to simply embarrass themselves. Mm-hmm. I think part of the delight for me, though, in seeing this movie, I have to admit, was the context in which I saw it, which was on opening day at the AMC Century City Theaters, like in the Westfield Mall. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, the only other people seeing the movie at Century City that day fit into one of two categories. The first category was hugely, grossly overweight women playing Bejeweled. They did not seem to know one another, but they all acknowledged that each other was playing Bejeweled. Not kidding. It was a real thing that happened. And the other thing was unaccompanied children.
Really?
It was the most bizarre viewing experience I've had, maybe in my lifetime, but certainly within the last year. I was just like, why are all these children here? Why are all these overweight women playing Bejeweled in this theater?
You think maybe you got catfished at the screening?
I think I did get catfished. I think the nerve, the nerve.
The nerve of that nerve.
But yeah, it's still out in theaters. It's not a super wide release. Mm-hmm. I think, like, for me, it was either go to Century City or go to the Universal City Walk to go see it, you know, which I would prefer to go to the Grove, which is just down the street from me.
But I'm excited to watch this movie on an international flight in the next 6 months.
Yeah, so you will be.
This is gonna to see this in a theater. It's so fun. It's so fun. Emma Roberts sings Wu-Tang Clan's Cream while getting a tattoo.
Well, then I'm in. Right. Now, sign me up. Now I'm going to start playing Bejeweled.
Oh, no. And eating cake. No. So now the trailers coming up. Let's talk about Rogue One, the Star Wars story. Okay. Now, this is a much longer trailer came out. This does break your rule about not seeing the Star Wars trailers.
I got to say, since we started doing... I'm so torn because... Since we started like talking about trailers on the show, I'm watching more trailers online.
Right.
I prefer to see big trailers like this. I wish I could have seen this in the theater.
In the theater, yeah.
That being said, it looks fucking awesome.
Yeah, it looks really
good. I'm so fired up, and the fact that Disney is doing this, I feel like, and I know this is a bold statement. Look, I had a lot of fun at A Force Awakens. We talked about that movie at great length. If you're new to this show, go back and listen to our episode 300, and then we did another spoiler ep. We talked about that movie on two separate episodes were completely dedicated to that film. So it was fun. It was great. I feel like, and as I talked about on those shows, having went back and watched A New Hope again on VHS, New Hope, I love it. Great. My childhood. It's not a great movie. I mean, you know, if you were to see that as an adult today, you'd go, For the very first time, you'd go, not great acting.
What's going on with the effects?
You know, you'd be like, there's a lot of sexist crap from Han Solo. You'd be like, there's a lot of like...
It's kind of corny jokes.
Corny jokes. I feel like now what they're doing, these whatever they're being called, these other storylines or these
side stories,
I think we're going to get great stuff because A Force Awakens had to do certain things. It had to bring back all the original characters, which I'm glad they did, and I cheered every time they showed up on screen. But I think now they can just unbridled Star Wars, let's get gritty.
I think we're headed in that direction, and each movie is a step there because you also have... you know, this is a prequel slash side story, so you can add the new characters and the new stories, but you still have the framework of stealing the plans, Darth Vader, the Death Star. That still has to be there in there somewhere. I think as we progress, as Disney, you know, continues to explore this universe, I think you're going to see brand new stories with brand new characters that don't even have references to some of these other movies. And it's great, but I don't think we're there yet. But that being said, I think it looks great, too. I can't wait to see it. I just love watching the walkers in the jungle.
Well, the thing that's really cool to me is, this is the guy that directed Monsters.
Yes, he got he got picked up pretty quickly. He did one independent film on his laptop, literally, and
then did Godzilla. And then after did that. Godzilla, which has a lot of fucking giant problems. The biggest one is we never see the goddamn Godzilla until like an hour into the film. But to me, what you're saying, Chris, of the they're getting the Death Star plans, that actually is what is exciting to me because. You know, in the original movie or whatever, that's just sort of, you know, many Bothans died getting this information. Like, that's just kind of thrown out there.
How did Princess Leia get them?
How did, like, that is so, I'm so intrigued by that. And I think, I don't know, I'm getting way caught up. I think I'm so fired up for this movie. because I think it's going to surprise the shit out of people. I think people are kind of like, oh, cool.
I think it'll be good, yeah.
You know, but I feel like it's going to do what like graphic novels did in the 80s to comic books. Going from fun kids and sci-fi stories to like really gritty getting into it. That's my
prediction. Still Disney.
Still Disney.
We're not going to get an R Star Wars movie.
No, we're not.
We're going to get from PG-13 to hard PG-13.
Yeah.
That's where we're going to be pretty much.
But I think it's going to be cool.
Mm-hmm.
I'm excited.
Yeah, me too. And the next one is Dunkirk.
Christopher Nolan,
Nolan's Dunkirk.
Yes, mm-hmm. Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk.
Not to be confused with...
with the other, you know, with
someone
Brett Ratner's Dunkirk. Yeah.
Hey, say what you will about Brett Ratner. He actually does a lot of film restoration work. I don't know if you know that.
I did not know that.
Supports a lot of...
That's good.
He should do more.
He should just stick to
that. Yeah, he should really do more of that. I think that's great. Good for him. So I think the thing about Dunkirk, what I love about the teaser trailer is the first part of the teaser is Christopher Nolan's resume in cards, mm-hmm. like from the director of, okay, no, we know, we got it. Show us the money shot. And then it gets into...
It's a great
basically
teaser.
Set up. It is a great teaser. And you can also see it has those shades of like Saving Private Ryan of like these are going to be really intense battle scenes and they're going to be state-of-the-art special effects and we're going to make this massive and epic and grand and we're going to put you in the middle of this this battle.
What did you think of the trailer, Samuel?
I think it's all money shot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think you're right. It doesn't tell you a lot about it except that get ready, something big is coming.
Yeah, this is like it's literally a teaser in every sense of the word. This is a promise of like, yes, look what's coming. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Are you a fan of Christopher Nolan?
I have been in the past. I have to be honest, I didn't see the most recent film of his, Interstellar.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of engaging with something for 3+ hours that I had zero interest in, surprise, didn't appeal to me. But yeah, I'm cautiously optimistic about this. I enjoyed the Batman films.
Mm-hmm.
They sort of decreased in quality as they went along, I thought. But I don't know. I really don't know too much about Dunkirk other than what we see in the teaser. But I mean, if it is shot on film and if it's all practical effects, I mean, that might be...
Well, there's no way it's practical effects. Just that one money shot. There's no way. That would have been a lot of extras.
Right. I suppose. Yeah. I don't know.
I think it'll be, if he's smart, he'll do like what he did in the Batman films, which is practical on like the close-up stuff.
Sure.
Right.
The car chases and that stuff was in a lot of like Batman stunts he did practically. And then the bigger wide, obviously the wide shots, you have to go.
Yeah, you have to go.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I'm not a snob about CGI, but I'm a huge fan of narratively supported use of CGI.
Yes.
Well, yes, of course.
Like if it is called
with the exception
for,
of Suicide Squad. So, when clearly there was an extra CGI budget when a random member of the team got to turn into a monster.
So. It's on, bitch.
Spoiler alert on Suicide Squad.
My kingdom for a gif of that moment. Or gif. Yeah. Yell at me on Twitter some more about that.
All right, let's go into DVDs.
DVDs. The Angry Birds movie. Was a terrible film. And I didn't expect it to be good, but I thought it would at least be watchable. It was not. It was absolutely... Play the game. Pay the 99 cents. Play the game. Avoid this film.
Right.
The next one is God's Not Dead 2. I didn't see the first one, but I'm assuming God still isn't dead in the sequel.
When a high school teacher is asked a question in class about Jesus, her response lands her in deep trouble.
Yes.
Who is responsible for this?
Because
who did this?
It's interesting. The sequel, I read the description. It's basically about how Christians have to kind of navigate modern life and how
they're ostracized for saying that I believe.
Prosecuted, for believing Jesus all the way to like the Supreme Court. So,
aye.
So it's this movie is made for a very specific audience. So I'm sure. Like, what are the budgets on these movies? Does it say
$5 million?
It's actually a little higher than I thought they'd be.
Yeah,
but there's definitely a market for them for sure. The problem is, and we've heard this about. I think Tyler was talking about this before as someone. as a Christian who likes and watches a lot of Christian movies, he's like, you know, Christian movies, if they were just better, more people would watch them. Like, he said, make the movie good first, and then you can actually, if you want to make a, quote, Christian movie, which is, I think, a valid point.
Yeah.
The next is Site Spotlight and the fan feedback. Neil's weekly film news, CJ's review of Blood Father, which is the Mel Gibson Taken movie, and Florence Foster Jenkins, the new Meryl Streep film. So you can check those out on the site. And been a lot of really good Twitter comments as well. We've been watching those, a lot of interaction. And one of the things, like I said, we like you guys to be beta testers every once in a while. Let us know if you can comment on the articles. So that should be working. Like if you read Neil's articles or if you read like CJ's review and you have a comment, I want to make sure those are working. So check out, see if you can comment on those. And also, premiering this week, the remake of Ben-Hur. Wow. Somebody's going to lose some money.
Or Ben him.
I don't even know how the pitch went like this. Well, it's Fast and the Furious with chariots. Because if you look at the way it's shot, it's like it's all just slick, glossy, and it's the director of Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, who also, it's a Russian director, who also did Night Watch and Day Watch, which was all kind of crazy effects-driven,
I don't know,
nonsense,
man.
Shots. You could call them. It looks ridiculous. The entire movie looks ridiculous.
Like, go find a nice restored version of the original.
Yes, exactly.
Nobody is asking for this movie.
No, no one's asked for it.
I'm sorry to say.
I don't think there's a demand for it. And even if there was some way to remake this film in an interesting and compelling and stylized way, this wouldn't be it.
Yeah.
So
agreed.
I want to give a quick fan feedback. I reposted an article on the Comedy Film Writ site of the open letter to the Warner Brothers CEO. And I just wrote my thoughts exactly, and we had a lot of responses from you guys. Mikey Garland wrote, "This is great, but it doesn't matter because the asshole running the studio clearly doesn't give a fuck about anyone or anything." Thanks, Mikey. Appreciate the thoughts on that.
A calm, considered response from Mikey.
Yes. And not wrong.
Not wrong. Morgan Field just writes, "Yeah, nailed it." Appreciate the response on that. So,
and the next movie coming out is Kubo and the Two Strings, and I am unbelievably excited about this movie.
It looks really cool.
It looks fantastic.
It looks like it's sort of doing all of the right things that like Kung Fu Panda 1 and 3 did.
Yes. And also just the stop-motion animation, which is pretty much a dying art. There's only literally one studio doing it anymore, and it's this one. They did Box Trolls and a couple other ones. And I'm kind of in the middle of Box Trolls right now. My kids have already seen it, but they wanted to see it again. And it's unbelievable, the painstaking detail of these models and these environments, and they're really, really beautiful. So this has everything I love. Stop-motion animation, fantasy, and a samurai movie all kind of together. And I love that, like, it's like the hero, the little boy, he's missing an eye, so he has an eye patch. So it looks really, really cool. And it seems like it also kind of plays around with the conventions a little bit, like, you know, the monkey is the mentor that's kind of taking him through this journey. And can't you ever say anything like positive and hopeful? And she just says something like, and it's Shirley's Throne is voicing the monkey. It's like, well,
of course.
She says something like, I don't remember the exact quote in the trailer, but it's funny. It was like, well, I'm hopeful that you won't die. You know, something like ridiculous. But it looks like a really fun movie. I'm excited. My kids are excited to see it. We will be seeing it this weekend. And I'm glad to see, too, that this type of technology, like stop motion animation, isn't completely dead. There's at least one company still doing it. So I'm there.
Coming out also is War Dogs.
Yes.
So this looks, I can't decide on this movie because it is based on a true story. That is intriguing to me. I really like Miles Teller. Jonah Hill, when he's not being all Jonah Hilly, is I can handle.
I'd like to know too how much of it is based on a true story,
right?
Like, and how much is like creative license, like, because in some of the scenes it looks like there's no way that really.
It's directed by Todd Phillips, so he did Old School, and he also did The Hangover, but he also did Due Date and Hangover 2 and 3.
Let's not forget Road Trip, which I actually love.
So it's like, I don't know. I don't know if it's...
I'm not on board for this movie. I can almost guarantee you at some point in the runtime of this film, there's going to be a line, something to the effect of, they're not dogs, they're gods. And the fact that that might happen makes me want to die.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I can see
something why. Like that is going to happen in this movie.
And that might just be in the director's cut. You know, you don't know. It might not be in theatrical version.
What if it happens every 20 minutes?
Yeah, I'm...
Then it was per studio note.
Yeah. I don't know. There's a lot of questions about this that I don't know. It might just have a really slick trailer and then...
Could be. And it could be a mess.
It could be a mess.
I think any sliver of a chance that I was going to see this movie disappeared as soon as there was a Scarface-inspired poster.
Oh, I don't know if you've seen that. Yeah, yeah, I know what you're talking
yeah.
about.
Yeah, it's pretty heinous.
So, and the next movie...
It is pretty heinous.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
I think they just photoshopped the heads off of Scarface. That like yeah, literally, they just add, the
well, they
same
added
exact
a second
poster.
Head. They yeah. just put in Miles. They put a second yeah. head in there.
Also, this is going to be Jonah Hill being very Jonah Hill-y throughout the whole thing.
Yeah, but
almost certainly
with a gun. Yeah,
that makes it worse.
I know. Yeah, I think you sadly could be correct on that.
I wanted to mention this next movie, even though it's in a limited release, just because it's an interesting experiment, I think, for Sony. It's called Kingsglaive Final Fantasy XV. Now, it is obviously based on a video game, but what's interesting is that the video game isn't out yet. So the question is, will the fans go to see this? And Final Fantasy movies have not had a... let's say, a good history at the box office, and also with the critics, and also with just people watching them. They've been terrible. There's The Spirits Within was generic and awful, and then...
Water Trash.
Yeah, and then there was another one, Final Fantasy Advent Children, that was completely incomprehensible.
Yeah, it's a bonkers movie.
Yeah, it really made no sense. So... I watched the trailer in this movie. It's got like Aaron Paul and a couple like Lena Headey, like some actual Hollywood voices.
I thought it was live action for a second. I was like, holy shit.
No, it was, you know, you can see the technology, the way we've advanced where there's a couple times where you kind of have to look twice, like, wait, is that animated or is that, you know, realistic? So,
do you know where this takes place? Like if it's before the events of the game?
It has to be before because the way the release schedule is, it has to be kind of like a prequel. So I'm wondering, like, is there something to the fact, because it's released by Sony PlayStation, and you know, even though it's a Japanese company, Square Enix made the film.
Certainly.
Like, were the bean counters figuring out, you know, if we release this movie, it'll generate enough interest in the game, and it doesn't matter if the movie doesn't make money, we'll make it back up in game sales.
I wouldn't doubt that at all. Yeah. I think the gaming world, there's so much money there. I think they're coming at movies... from a completely different strategy.
Correct.
They're not coming at like that old of like, the movie is the top of the mountain.
Right.
You make this thing, whatever it is, a book, a video game, a comic, and then it's a movie. And I think they're just like, the movie is just like a rung on their marketing ladder.
Right, to drive the video
game sales. To drive the video game sales, because video game sales are just fucking insane.
Right. Yeah. You know, the movie's 10 to 15 a ticket, a video game is 60.
Yeah, I don't think Final Fantasy 15 needs any help or promotion. Like, I think everybody who's going to buy that is already on board.
It's what they call like a AAA title. This is the one where it drives system sales. People buy this system just to play that game.
For sure.
And it's been in development for how many years now?
Like over five, sure.
Yeah,
like,
so it's a big giant. Basically, I mean, if you had the same terms, it would be a tentpole game. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that they're releasing a movie to support, like you're saying, a tentpole game.
Yeah, this is the first time I'm hearing about this movie, but like knowing a little bit about this game, I have to wonder if...
Are you a gamer?
Sort of very casually. I think like... Two very good friends of mine who are based like in and around the Chicago area are like weirdly like YouTube celebrities and like do Let's Plays. Are you familiar with that like subgenre?
Watch me play?
Yeah, yeah.
That is so fascinating to me on YouTube that there's people, huge followings, making a crazy money.
It's like toy unboxing.
Kind of, they do it from a more of like an intellectual sort of like comedic commentary space. Mm-hmm. And so... Most of my knowledge from video gaming or of video gaming is through that filter.
Right.
Of them sort of playing through these games and showing how everything works and revealing, you know, little secrets and, you know, alongside humorous commentary. But through that filter, I know at least enough about Final Fantasy 15 to know that it's kind of an atypical plot, or like the characters are slightly atypical, and that it's kind of like a boy band is kind of like the the main characters. It's like four dudes, four bros in a car, sort of just like chilling out together. My thought process, not knowing too much about this movie or really anything about this movie before you mentioned it.
By the way, the trailer tells you nothing when you watch
that.
The
doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, it's like, well, I still that doesn't have no surprise idea. Me. Okay, there's a crystal. There's a battle. There's a king.
Par for the Final Fantasy course.
And there's monsters and vehicles. Got it.
Got it.
I can't help but wonder, though, if the movie's relationship to the final game is anything like Metal Gear Solid, The Phantom Pain's relationship to Ground Zeroes. Ground Zeroes was a sort of like rushed early version of Metal Gear Solid 5. It was actually a video game. But it basically kind of functioned as a sort of long-form demonstration version that was released because the full game was sort of running late. Like it
interesting.
It was delayed in terms of its schedule.
I think the way this is being set up is more of like, this is a prequel to set you up to play the game. It really feels that way. I mean, when it comes out, we could figure it out. We could find out.
Yeah,
yeah. So it really feels that way, and it feels like a specific strategy. And also, it's like it's not like they just throw it together. It's not like you know, he still takes a fair amount of money for rendering and hiring the voice talent and stuff. So it wasn't an afterthought. So we'll see. Yeah. We'll see how it does.
All right, cool. Episode triple threes.
Yep,
put it in the books. Lock it down.
Lock it in.
Lock it down.
Yeah.
Look it up. I don't know what I'm saying.
Oh, one of the things I wanted to mention, too, is we have a couple of new things in the store. We are now carrying all of the Crab Feast merchandise.
Nice.
So there are, I believe, three different styles of t-shirts. There, we don't have all the sizes in, but we'll definitely be reordering. But whatever we have is on the site now. So if you're a Crab Feast fan, check it out. You can buy the shirts from
Crab
us
Feast
now.
Is also in LA Podfest.
Yes, also in LA Podfest.
LAPodfest.com.
We're actually doing really, we're really, really excited about Podfest this year. I have to say, this is a really cool year for us. We've got a lot of really big shows. We've got a lot of some of your favorites. But we're going to be doing some cool things with the parties and the live
stream. We've got Welcome to Night Vale. We've got Criminal. Those are giant shows.
And Rooster Teeth and Dude Soup.
Those are huge shows. Talk about gaming.
Yeah.
Those are giant shows.
Yeah. And it's going to be really, really fun.
My Favorite Murder, which is Karen Kilgariff's new show, which has skyrocketed.
Yep.
Which is fantastic. Like we've both known Karen for years. Never,
and Stuff You Should Know.
Is back again. Mm-hmm. These are huge, huge shows.
Yeah, hundreds of thousands of listeners each show.
Some of them
in the millions.
Some of them in the millions. Yeah. So these are giant shows on top of like, you know, your favorites who charted.
And I'm personally excited because I get to meet Will Wheaton. He's going to be on the show. It's weird, but like, I'm excited to meet a guest. Like, he's going to be, oh, this is going to be awesome. And I was talking to Jackie Cation, and because Will Wheaton does a gaming kind of like video podcast.
Tabletop.
Right? Yeah. And Jackie was so excited. She was like, you have to have me on the show, and then I will have every single one of your staff on to Dork Forest. So they took the deal. So
that's awesome. Cool. Well, that's our show. So, Samuel, how can people reach you online? What do you got? Website?
Yeah. You can find me on Twitter at SB Prime. Same for Facebook if you use that as well. My website is lacinesalon.com. LACINESALON. It's basically a space where I post film reviews. There are occasional web-based screenings of contemporary undistributed movies, as well as essays and like fun little like video experiments, like weird stuff that I just edit together. You know, sometimes you just watch a mid-80s feel-good gymnastics movie and feel like, hey, I think there's a horror movie buried inside this. And, and then you make that trailer.
Well, that's what you did at the Junk Show, which I thought was really cool. You recut a movie, which I think is so cool. I love seeing that.
Yeah, that's something that I've wanted to do for a while. It's a friend of mine, Jean-Baptiste Leonetti, made this movie, which was based on this YA novel called The Reach. Mm-hmm. The movie was called Beyond the Reach, and he made it with Michael Douglas. And he had in his mind that he wanted this to be kind of like top, wild B-movie Western. But Michael Douglas, I think, wanted it to be a sort of Oscar contention drama. Mm-hmm. And so the movie, as it was released and as it exists, doesn't quite work. And so what I tried to do for the Junk Show and for the movie itself was try to unearth that wild B-movie buried inside.
So keep any new stuff you're doing, email it to us. We'll post it on our Facebook page and stuff like that. I think our fans would love that stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So also a true fact that I just want to let everybody know is that I'm in Knight of Cups, the Terrence Malick movie. I have a cameo in it. Mm-hmm. It's actually a rumor I want to spread, but tell everyone that it's a true fact. It's my Godard's King Lear.
Nice. Okay. I'm performing in Camarillo tomorrow night, the 17th. Got some other shows coming up. September 1st, we'll be up in Seattle doing a little podcast about movies with another gentleman. check that out, guys. Follow at Comedy Film Nerds on Twitter and Instagram, our Facebook page, like it. Positive reviews, guys. We talk about, spend $20 with us once a year, and that can keep us afloat. If you're looking to do something right now, there's some new, like you said, there's new merchandise on the website or by the live stream. Use coupon code CFN. The show gets paid by when you use our coupon code.
Yep, that helps too.
That helps too.
You know, and if you can't, you're financially strapped, no worries. Good reviews, like Graham is saying.
Five-star reviews on iTunes.
On iTunes, all that helps. Plenty of things to do for free.
Clicking a like button, retweeting a Comedy Film Nerds tweet, following us on the social media, all those things are great and help. And tell your friends, whoever you've got on your other social media is something that was really cool.
And I will say, too, you guys have been asking if we'll do more spoiler eps and also movie commentaries throughout whole films, especially movies that we don't want to see. We're going to be exploring that after the festival. We're going to be seeing if we can kind of put all that together.
We love doing the spoiler eps. It's a scheduling thing. We love doing them. We'll try to do more, but the commentary on movies, that's going to happen.
We're working on that.
Working on that. So you guys are awesome. Thanks for all your support. And thank you once again, Samuel Prime, for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
My name is Graham Elwood.
And I'm Chris Mancini. And as always, remember,
Han shot first.
Metropolis.
Where is it?